President Obama today signed a new education bill into law, replacing No Child Left Behind. It'll give states and districts more control over their schools.
It is good because it helps better balance the role of federal, state, and local school governance.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, a call to arms that concerns some law enforcement agencies getting ready for this winter's El Nino.
Why a majority of Arizonans are adding caregiver to their resumes.
And it's end scene for a Valley Cinematic landmark.
The new place, I'm sure, will be very nice, and you can describe it in many ways, but the one way you can't describe it is funky old art house.
Plus, we drop a line and check out another Valley Hot Corner.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high of 76. It's 72 degrees right now.
There's more bad news for the city of Kingman. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, an internal audit has found much more money than first thought missing from a city trust account.
Kingman's budget analyst Diane Richards was fired last month after special agents from the federal government and officials from the Arizona Attorney General raided her office. Richards was accused then of stealing about $300,000 from the employee's benefit trust account. Now, according to the Kingman Daily Miner, an audit has found more than $1.1 million may have gone missing from the account over a period of 8 years. And to make matters worse, the city's insurance against employee theft has only a $500,000 cap. Richards, who's not yet been formally charged, faces potential charges of fraudulent schemes, computer tampering, money laundering, and theft. She has reportedly been cooperating with investigators. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
President Obama earlier today signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, which will replace No Child Left Behind. Both the House and Senate overwhelmingly approved the measure with bipartisan support. The new law, among other provisions, reduces the federal government's role in public education and changes how standardized test results are used. Tim Ogle is the executive director of the Arizona School Boards Association. And Tim, is this a good thing for Arizona?
I think it is a good thing, Mark, and yes, it's good in a number of ways. Just from a more political commentary, it's great that we got bipartisan support on K-12 education, with a Congress as divisive as this one is. And yes, it is good because it helps better balance the role of federal, state, and local school governance.
In what ways do you think this will change how your members go about doing their jobs?
I think it'll change the way our members do their jobs in a number of ways. And I think to understand how that might happen, you have to kind of understand some of the flaws in No Child Left Behind, which this act, ESSA, or Every Student Success Act, will replace. So No Child Left Behind will phase out. This will phase in. And with No Child Left Behind, there were accountability measures that were so specific and stringent that they were virtually unmanageable and could never be achieved. So therefore, it kind of deemed No Child Left Behind as unrealistic. What ESSA will now do is let our 13,000 school districts in our country, of course, 240 of those in Arizona, it will allow them to establish accountability measures, school rating systems, remediation plans for underperformance. Those responsibilities will now reside with local governance, board superintendent teams, and that's a good thing.
Some of the critics, including Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, worry that there was still too much of the federal government in this bill. Is that a concern for you?
That's always a concern. Of course, those of us in the profession know that best governance is local democracy at the school board level, and that's how we get real school reform, is one district at a time. And there's a million children that come across our threshold every day, and they are owed the best system. And so we look forward to this transition. The role of the federal government is maybe important so that we have some kind of national commonality of purpose. But when you get into the specific implementation strategies and specific kinds of programmatic issues, the nuance of the local community should rule.
How long do you think it will take before the provisions of this new law are really phased in and we start to see some of their effects in Arizona?
You'll see here in the next week or so rolling out, there is a transition plan. I just got it this morning, a copy of it. No Child Left Behind phases out. The new law phases in from now through 17.
Okay, so it'll be a little while. We'll start sort of seeing gradual changes.
Yes, you'll see each piece, kind of one piece move out, another piece move in here, and that will be released here in the days ahead.
Tim Ogle is the executive director of the Arizona School Boards Association. Tim, thank you.
My pleasure.
FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is letting Western states, including Arizona, know about how it's planning to respond to the potentially destructive impact of El Niño. Flooding and landslides are two of the major concerns, as forecasters anticipate a wetter-than-normal winter. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a National Weather Service meteorologist. First, though, we turn to April Slutsky, Public Information Officer for the Arizona Department of Emergency and Military Affairs. April, what sort of preparation has Arizona started to do for a potentially strong El Niño?
For the state of Arizona, the biggest concern really is flooding, whether that starts with excessive snow or just continuous rain, because our ground really cannot control a lot of water. So what we've been doing in Arizona is we've been using a layered approach to educate the residents as well as our emergency response and recovery partners. So we've been doing things like we have hosted a handful of workshops. We had one with 110 response and recovery partners that came out to talk about the predictions with National Weather Service, and we talked about things that have happened in previous El Niños and what our personal roles and responsibilities are. We've also talked to about 500 stakeholders, which would include voluntary agencies, private businesses, donation management, and what their jobs might be if there was excessive flooding and whatnot.
And how much of this is going to be the responsibility of government, and how much is it going to be that by raising awareness, the average person who lives in Arizona just should know what's going on, and if in fact they need to do the sort of preparation you're talking about? Are there certain tips you can tell us that FEMA has told people to get ready for, and is that more likely in rural parts of the state?
So when it comes to a disaster in Arizona, those really do start at the local levels, and that would be starting with the residents. So it's really important to know what the risks are in your community and whether you live in a floodplain. So you can go onto floodsmart.gov and enter your community information, and that'll help you out. You can also sign up to receive emergency notifications from your particular county. And usually in Arizona, it's going to be not so much in the Phoenix area. However, we have seen flooding. We saw that a couple Septembers ago. But, you know, up more north and south and the different parts of the state. But even here, you know, locally, you need to be prepared. Your neighborhood could flood. You could get trapped in your house. And what are you going to do when you're there? So besides the emergency notifications, we have people, you know, have a family communication plan so you know who to call and how you're going to leave your house if you need to. And have a 72-hour emergency supply kit in case you do get stuck at your house for a while without power. So you'll have the appropriate food and water that you need. So you will be okay for a little while on your own.
And is Arizona also in communication with, let's say, California and Nevada?
One of our assistant directors actually was in California yesterday. We're part of FEMA Region 9. So he went out there and participated in a tabletop exercise and workshop to talk about what we can do together as partners. And Arizona is also part of something called the Emergency Mutual Aid Compact, which means if a state needs help from other states, we are there to provide assistance, whether it's personnel or resources and vice versa.
But isn't there an irony, too? We talked about such this long-running drought, and now we're getting a wet winter potential of El Niño, but it might be too wet.
One of the big problems with Arizona, because everybody says, ooh, a lot of rain is good, but because we're so in such a drought state, our ground cannot handle a lot of water. And then another of those problems is anywhere there's been a wildfire in the state, that if we get an excessive amount of rain there, that could lead to more than just flooding. That could lead to the landslides and all that other stuff. So it really is, it's a fine line between needing rain, but not too much rain.
April Slutsky, Public Information Officer for the Arizona Department of Emergency and Military Affairs.
So what kind of El Niño are forecasters expecting? To find out, we turn to Ken Waters, Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Phoenix. And Ken, what are you looking for?
Well, we're
we're standing pat with the forecast. We're expecting a strong El Nino. We're actually in a strong El Nino pattern already. And all expectations is that's going to last through the winter. And actually, so far, it appears this event is going to be right up on par with maybe the top two or three events of all time that we have on record.
And when you say a strong El Nino, does that mean lots of precipitation?
Generally, yes. Now, each El Nino is different, but basically with that warm pool of water, it does tend to pool what we call the subtropical jet stream further to the south and bring it on kind of basically over Southern California and on into Arizona. And that would tend to facilitate bringing in multiple storm systems kind of one after another, sort of like a little bit like what we're seeing right now in the Northwest, you know, Northern California with the rainstorms they've been having.
Are you expecting rain for the Phoenix area, snow in the high country?
Yeah, that is the expectation. As far as temperatures go, typically an El Nino for us typically is going to be maybe a little on the warmer side, warmer than normal. So that could potentially have impact on the snow levels and raise them up a little bit. But that would be offset also by a good chance of more precipitation, you know, higher amounts. So we're kind of anticipating more rain days, you know, more days with rain, and then also larger amounts of rainfall across the area.
Do you have a sense of how much rain the Phoenix area might see this winter?
It's really hard to say, but when we compare this El Nino to some of the previous ones, especially the strong ones, we could see potentially maybe about 1 or 2 or even 3 inches more rainfall than normal for the winter. And for the Phoenix area, we're talking normally 4 inches or so. So we have the potential to see maybe 6 or 7 inches in the Phoenix area. But the good news is not all at once. We're not talking about an expectation of very, very strong flooding type systems. More a sense of just more rain, but spread out over more time. So that's good news, certainly.
Ken Waters is warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Phoenix, talking about this winter's El Nino. Ken, thank you.
You bet, Mark. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, are more guns the answer to the increase in mass shootings?
People may imagine that society would inherently be safer if everybody was armed, but I don't think we fully appreciate what kind of society that really would be.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark. I'm Steve. We're going to stay partly to mostly sunny for the rest of the afternoon around the valley, looking to top out at 76 degrees, currently with relative humidity at 20%. We're at 74, and in Valley traffic, an accident on the 60 westbound at 19th Avenue, and that's blocking the right lane. It's 216.
KJZZ is supported by Honor Health, still locally owned and not-for-profit. Scottsdale Healthcare and John C. Lincoln Health Network have merged and are making healthy personal. More information can be found at honorhealth.com.
In the wake of several recent mass shootings, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio is calling for Arizonans that carry concealed weapons to take action in the event of another attack. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, not all law enforcement officials think Arpaio's call to arms is the best course of action.
Sheriff Arpaio has a long history of recruiting private citizens to support his department's activities. He created a volunteer posse program at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department in 1993, and it's grown over the years to more than 50 units. Posse members undergo training and are usually asked to serve in supporting roles for activities like search and rescue. But in light of recent mass shooting events, Arpaio is now asking members of the public to go a step further.
We have about 250,000 citizens in Arizona to carry concealed weapons that we know of. And I decided to ask for their help.
In several recent statements, Arpaio has encouraged armed members of the public to use deadly force if they're in the presence of an active shooter.
That person could take action, even take down that shooter, and save many, many lives before the cops show up.
However, this call to arms goes against the advice of many other law enforcement agencies. In the event of an active shooter, Kurt Remus of the Phoenix FBI actually advocates the exact opposite response.
The first option certainly is running, help others escape if possible, and call 911 when you are safe.
Fighting back, he says, should actually be a last resort. Remus is no stranger to active shooter scenarios. He was a first responder to the Columbine High School shooting in 1999 and says additional shooters would only add to the chaos when law enforcement arrives on the scene.
In a situation like that, you don't know who the shooters are. It was described as a student. Well, a school is full of students, so therefore you don't know who the shooters are. So, you know, the persons who are evacuating need to have their hands visibly clear so the law enforcement who is arriving can see if you are a threat or not.
But Arpaio argues it's that time before law enforcement arrives when armed citizens could be the most effective, despite their chances of being mistaken for the shooter.
That's just a risk that you have to take. You got to be proactive and willing to take some chances to save lives.
The truth of the matter is that each person who finds themselves in a situation like this is going to rely on instinct. And they're going to take the action that they perceive is most likely to keep them safe, to keep others safe, to protect themselves. And that's going to vary from person to person.
Michael Scott is a professor at Arizona State University's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. He says mass shootings have changed the way police and society think about how we defend ourselves from violence.
And especially with high-powered and weapons and magazines with lots of ammunition, a lot of people can die in a short period of time.
While the natural inclination might be to take matters into our own hands, Scott says doing so could have unintended consequences.
People may imagine that society would inherently be safer if everybody was armed, but I don't think we fully appreciate what kind of society that really would be.
He says the very reason we entrust police officers with the use of deadly force is so that hopefully we don't have to use it ourselves. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
AARP of Arizona says more than half of state residents older than 45 are or have been caregivers to an older adult. The group survey finds those caregivers are also often caring for their own kids or other younger family members. Here with more on this is Dana Kennedy, State Director for AARP Arizona. And Dana, what led you to look into this in the first place?
We know that a majority of people are actually going to become caregivers. And so we thought that we'd actually dig a little deeper and find out what type of help and assistance caregivers needed. And also we wanted to look at what type of care they're providing.
And what type of care do they tend to be providing?
The survey found that the majority of care that they're giving, 87% provide transportation to appointments, 86% aid with household chores, 73% oversee medications, and 63% own money to help or use their own money to help provide care.
Now, we should clarify that this doesn't involve like parents bringing their kids to the pediatrician. This is people who are taking care of somebody older than they are, right?
Yeah. For purposes of this conversation, we surveyed 1,600 caregivers, family caregivers, who are providing help to people who are adults who have special needs. So for the most part, these are children caring for their elderly parents.
What does all of that mean for the people who are doing it? What does it mean for the economy?
Well, we know that the people who are providing the care are really being, they're really stressed. So they're having to balance their work and home life and also care for their aging parent. And it means that they're also having to make difficult financial choices as well because they're providing their own money to help their loved one.
Have you found that people have had to leave jobs, for example, to care for maybe their elderly parents at one time of the day and then their kids in the evening to put them to sleep?
You know, 68% of the people that we surveyed, they actually have to modify their work schedules in order to care for their aging parent. That's huge, 68%.
And that presumably has a pretty big effect on the workforce and on the state's economy, right?
Oh, absolutely. It has a huge impact on the workforce because you're having to, you know, employers are having to deal with children who are caring for their aging parent.
Is the number you found in Arizona different than what is happening in other places?
It really isn't just what's happening in Arizona. This is happening nationwide.
Is there anything that can be done about this?
In our survey, we found that 87% would support some short-term help, like help with a home health aide, so family caregivers could get a break. We're also looking at lifespan respite. So that means that we would provide a financial benefit to be able to care for a loved one at home so they can take a break. Because it's not just anybody can come and care for your aging adult. They need somebody that they know is trained to be able to provide the adequate care.
Right. And I would imagine that in at least some cases, the kids who are taking care of their older parents really want to be able to help their parents, but maybe they're just not able to do it, or maybe they didn't know what was involved in taking care of them when they started doing it.
I mean, they need to be adequately trained. And I think that there's all kinds of little things that you could do to make sure that you don't have a back injury when you're caring for an aging loved one that may be bedbound. So there's just little things that can happen if you provide training that allows them to be able to care for them safely and be able to provide the care that they want to provide. I mean, most family members feel like this is my responsibility. My parent took care of me and I want to take care of my parent. That's my responsibility. They don't necessarily identify as being a caregiver. They often think that, you know, caregivers are paid. But many family members are providing the most intimate acts to take care of their loved ones.
Dana Kennedy is AARP's Arizona director. Dana, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
One of the most difficult conversations to have with an elderly parent or spouse is the one that involves taking away the car keys for good. Maybe it's poor eyesight or reduced dexterity that's made driving more dangerous. Whatever the case, not having a driver's license leads very rapidly to feeling a lack of independence. Arizona's Motor Vehicle Division has a program designed to keep unsafe drivers, not targeting the elderly, off the road. Those drivers can be reported to the agency via the MVD Medical Review Program. Arizona Department of Transportation spokesman Ryan Harding explains how it works.
MVD does have a program that we've implemented for public safety reasons that allows law enforcement, physicians, families, friends, and the public to report concerns about a driver's ability to safely operate a vehicle. People can go online and submit a form. And there are three separate forms. There's one just for the general public, there's one specifically for law enforcement officers, and there's one for physicians that they can submit if they have concerns about someone's ability to safely operate a vehicle.
And so it can be someone who may know the person or not know the person?
Yeah, and MVD weighs those on a case-by-case basis. So when we get a report, you know, they will look at, okay, who's the source of the information? Is it law enforcement? Is it someone like a family member? Or is it, you know, just a random citizen reporting someone who they don't even know who the driver's name is? You know, and that's all taken into account. And then also, what exactly are they reporting?
Yeah, Ryan, how specific a description does the system need to either really look into it or not? Or is there something that, are there keywords that might make it seem like, well, this is one we probably should spend a little more time with, or does each one at least get a little bit equal time at that first level?
Yeah, they have, the form has, you know, boxes that we could check that kind of generally cover the general category of what's going on. You know, is it a physical condition? Is it vision problems? Psychological condition? Things like that they can check. And then it has a space for the person to go into specific detail about what exactly they're concerned about. What have they seen? Things like that. And then they have to sign it, and then they can submit it to MVD. And then MVD will look at that and take the action that they deem appropriate.
So it can't be done anonymously?
That's correct. Right. We don't accept anonymous reports.
Is there a particular timeline that goes into effect? Let's say once MVD gets the concern, gets the complaint, whatever it may be, is there a situation where, okay, in the next month we handle this, in the next quarter we handle it, or we handle it as soon as possible?
If they determine that actions are needed, they will then send a letter to the driver that was reported with the, you know, saying, you know, you've been reported as whatever the report was, and then give a required or recommended course of action, and then the driver will typically have 30 days to complete that action.
I think one thing that struck me about the letter being official is, I'll tell you, in the one example I heard, when a person was just telling me the story and relating it to me, my first thought was, oh, well, that must be some fake thing, because we often hear from agencies, whether it's government or private agencies, say, you know,
we won't actually send this to you.
We take it seriously because, again, we want to have, you know, safe drivers on the road. We want people who can safely operate and control their vehicle. And so, you know, again, and then depending on that, we'll send them a letter requiring some action be taken. You know, that could be just come in and get a vision test because the report was my parent is getting older and they can't see very well and they refuse to wear glasses and that kind of thing. So come and get a vision test or maybe retake the road test, you know, or you need to go visit your physician and get checked out and then have your physician come back to us with a report.
ADOT spokesman Ryan Harding. We've been talking about the MVD Medical Review Program, which Harding says receives about 450 reports a month.
It's Thursday, December 10th, and this is The Show. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's no secret the United States Secret Service is an agency in crisis.
Perhaps what we should do is lean on the United States military, the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, others, to be assigned or detailed to the Secret Service for the next 12 months so that they can make it through the presidential election. We need people who can wield a gun, know what they're doing, and be trusted.
It's House Oversight and Government Reform Chairman Jason Chaffetz, who's a Republican of Utah, calling in the cavalry to help the Secret Service recover from a series of lapses over the last 7 years. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We've got a report now from the Congress and a call for action. Remind us of the lapses of the Secret Service and react to Chaffetz's call for other federal personnel to do the service's job.
This is a report detailing an agency in deep crisis. It's an ongoing investigation for about the last year, and it's just become final on the Hill. Now, some of these incidents are going to be familiar to you, and there's a lot new in this report, too. It really all starts back in November 2011. Shots fired at the White House from the Ellipse, just south of the White House, by a man with a semi-automatic rifle, and it took days and days for the Secret Service to determine the source of the bullets. In April 2012, the famous misconduct in Cartagena, Colombia, in advance of a presidential trip, Secret Service agents drinking, soliciting prostitution, bringing prostitutes back to their rooms and causing embarrassment for the White House. September 2014, the knife-wielding fence jumper who got over the fence, across the North Lawn and into the White House and made it as far as the East Room, but made it much further than Secret Service officials originally told Congress. They had to come back and clean up the story afterward, and then Director Julia Pearson resigned shortly after that incident. And then there was the incident last year, which you'll remember, at the Centers for Disease Control down in Atlanta, when a security contractor with a police record and a gun on him was able to get on an elevator with the president and stand right next to him. Listen to Secret Service Director John Clancy. He's been testifying on the Hill a lot lately.
And I've heard the comments that were made today, reprehensible, disturbing, embarrassing. I agree with everything that's been said here today, and my workforce does as well. But a hearing like this puts a definitive stamp on our failures.
Leadership failure? A culture of abuse? What's going on here?
Well, the report details an agency that is chronically understaffed, has had its staff cut by hundreds over the last couple years, both by budget cuts, which Congress bears part of the responsibility for, but also by attrition. Attrition, why? Because of low morale. People don't want to work there anymore. They want to get out. The report says there's a culture of targeting whistleblowers, that it's well known among agents and personnel that if you complain, that your complaints are going to be met possibly with retribution and certainly with the opprobrium of officials there. John, there's a lot new in this report, too, some of it pretty shocking. There's an incident from last September where a man posing as a congressman got past agents and was actually escorted to speak personally with the president backstage at a big awards dinner. There are several incidents of unauthorized and unscreened people getting near the president. There's also new details about that Cartagena trip that I mentioned, the one where Secret Service agents were soliciting prostitution and drinking. Emails detailed in the report among agents and even some officials prior to the trip sort of celebrating their plans to drink heavily, to bring extra cash for prostitutes, basically revealing, according to the report, a culture within the Secret Service where agents were pretty clear that this was part of their culture and that they weren't going to face retribution for it. There have been other incidents, John, that don't involve agents' personnel, including one very recently, just in the last couple of weeks, of a Secret Service employee working inside the White House who's been arrested for soliciting sex over text message from who he thought was a 14-year-old girl. It was actually a Delaware state trooper, and he's under arrest.
Quickly, Todd Zwillich, can the Marines or U.S. Marshals substitute for the Secret Service? Is that a call Congress can make? Can the president make it himself?
The Marines, probably not. Of course, we have rules in this country about the military operating domestically. U.S. Marshals, FBI could certainly, with an act of Congress, be reauthorized and activated. The president may be able to do it himself. We're not at that point yet, but this is an agency in crisis, and Congress is making a lot of noise about it.
And reform will be slow, slower probably than the campaign in 2016. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Joanne Hill with the Arizona Game and Fish Department's Community Fishing Program. Just drop them in. So what we're doing here at Steele Indian School Park is we just put 80 pounds of rainbow trout into this lake. You're looking at about 150 fish that went into here. These are our big semi-trucks. They're basically aquariums on wheels. So you have to get the net in there, chase them around a little bit. Everything gets wet. Everything gets fishy smelling. They're definitely wriggling in the net when we drop them into the lake. But they're pretty easy to handle. I've been doing this for over 10 years now, so I'm pretty used to it.
That's Joanne Hill with the Arizona Game and Fish Department restocking a lake with rainbow trout. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just wish you could throw us back, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Still to come, we hit up another Valley Hot Corner. This one's undergoing a bit of a facelift.
Obviously, the newness and the redevelopment, that's going to generate a lot of buzz and excitement, but also because there is this strong anchor of AJ's here, so there's kind of built-in traffic, and that's always good for restaurants.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody. We'll stay partly to mostly sunny for the rest of this afternoon. Look for a high temperature of 76. Partly cloudy tonight with lows in the lower 50s. And then for tomorrow, our weather starts to shift. It'll be partly cloudy with a high of 66. And then a chance for rain coming our way on Saturday with a high of 60 degrees. Currently, it's partly cloudy and 74. In Valley traffic, an accident on the 202 westbound at 32nd Street blocks the shoulder, and the HOV lane is blocked by a collision I-10 westbound at the 60. It's 236.
KJZZ is supported by Riley Carlock and Applewhite, a business law firm helping local and national clients in the areas of e-discovery and document review, banking and real estate, litigation, and more. Details at rcalaw.com.
Now for a look at international news on KJZZ. At the Paris Climate Talks, there is discussion on the amount of money needed by and given to developing countries to encourage them to move away from burning fossil fuels and into the use of renewables, leapfrogging the Industrial Revolution.
Renewable energy has already transformed lives in one tiny and remote Indonesian island. It's called Sumba and is just east of Bali. The BBC's Rebecca Henschke has more.
We've walked down around 200 steps in down a very sharp ravine, jungle on either side, and there here is a small waterfall. In the wet season, it's a gushing waterfall, but at the moment, it's only dribbling. It's where the children come to swim and the community comes to bathe, and now it's their source of electricity.
Kita berenang, cari ikan.
Local leader Umbu Hinga says he never dreamt that this swimming hole could produce electricity. But 4 years ago, a local aid group helped them build a micro hydro plant here that provides power for 350 homes.
Banyak hal yang berubah.
We now use electrical appliances for the kitchen and water pumps. It's brought about incredible change. Our whole region has stable electricity 24 hours a day, and it's 100% renewable energy.
The energy they don't use, they sell back to the state electricity company, earning the community around $600 a month. Of the 60 people in Sumba now connected to electricity, 40% are now using renewable energy. In less than 5 years, the government wants to turn off the remaining diesel generators and run on 100% clean power. We've climbed up from the micro hydro to the top of the ridge. It's a beautiful sunrise now. We're looking out across the hills, which are dotted with small communities. And also on the ridges are wind farms. These communities are getting their power from the wind. Paraju Ungara's grandson is the technician for one of the wind farms.
Before we had electricity, we used oil lamps, and we had to walk for a day and a half to the nearest town to buy it.
We've arrived at a school. This is a junior high school. And up until a few years ago, there was no electricity here at all. But now it's powered by micro hydro. Hello. In one of the classrooms, a teacher asks her students where they get their power from. Water, they shout back. What about the other island, she says? Coal that creates pollution, they answer. But the push towards renewables here is as much about economics as it is about the environment. The Indonesian government recently cut subsidies for diesel, making the generators on the island more expensive to run. The average household energy bill with micro hydropower is just $2 a month.
Everyone in Sumba lives close to pigs, and this is another source of clean energy, or not so clean. The waste from the pigs is turned into biogas that's pumped straight into the kitchen.
Selama ini kotoran hewan itu terbuang begitu saja.
Before, we would just throw away the waste, but now with new information, we are using it for free gas.
Hendrik Dengi leads a farmers co-op and is a facilitator of the renewable energy project.
This is not just about being proud of using clean energy. This is a chance for the people of Sumba to be freed from the chains of poverty that have always been around us.
Although the community is pleased to have the new power source, there are concerns of the effects. Local leader Umbo Hinga says they're trying to find a balance.
Children, if they are not controlled, watch too many soap operas and Western films on television. They stay up late and miss school the next day. That's a new challenge we now face after getting electricity.
The community knows it must adapt to changing circumstances, and the micro power station is helping them do just that. But if this renewable energy project is a success, in the medium to long term, the outside world will want to learn from them.
That's the BBC's Rebecca Henschke reporting from Indonesia.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Valley fans of independent films and those that could never be described as blockbusters are officially losing their favorite hangout tonight. The Harkins Camelview Theater, which has been around since 1973, is closing, and the building will be razed to make room for something else. Dan Harkins, who runs the Harkins Theater chain, will be opening a new 14-screen theater across the street at Scottsdale Fashion Square. That opens next week. Harkins says independent movies will find a home there, and we'll hear from Harkins in a few minutes. First joining me, though, is Arizona Republic and AZ Central film critic Bill Goodykunz. So, Bill, what have you thought of Camelview? both as a place to see movies and the role it's been playing.
I love it, and I'm really sorry to see it go. And for a couple of reasons. Before I was a movie critic, I mean, now I show up where they send me, you know. But Camel View, it's funky. It doesn't look like every other theater, and that sort of deco decor and I don't know if people remember this, but now, you know, some elaborate concession stand is kind of the norm. But at the time, you know, when Camel View started serving herbal tea and stuff, that was kind of wild stuff. I mean, it was like, and I think it really sort of added to what was going on there. And it just feels like a movie theater. And I think too often now, really nice movie theaters sometimes either feel like an office or like a glorified living room. Some of the luxury ones. I'm not a big fan of the luxury ones, but I think when you go to a movie, you ought to. You know, I'm old fashioned, I guess, but you ought to sit in your little chair and eat your popcorn. Camel View had a different feel, and part of that was what they played.
Is it good that that's a haven for folks? I think about my parents, but you know, they go to Camel View frequently, and what's nice for them is they can park, walk right up. And they know that they're not going to be standing next to someone who's going to see the Avengers or something. It's like it's sort of that safe haven.
There is that feeling that quality is not quite the right word, but just sort of attitude or some. It's actually become a descriptive word. It's become an adjective. Is that a Camel View film? Mm-hmm. That's what people ask me. My editors ask me that. Oh, is this a Camel View film? It means something, and it does. And I think that to some people it means, oh, hoity-toity or something. To some people it means good. You know, it just depends on who you are and what you want to see. But there have been weeks there where I think you could go and spend your whole day, just go from one theater to the next and see, you know, a lot of Oscar contenders, a lot of really good movies.
Do you have in your mind maybe the top three movies you've ever seen at Camel View? The three that would have gained widespread Valley audiences because of Camel View.
I think one of my favorite examples of like what you call maybe a Camel View movie was the Grand Budapest Hotel. It opened there and it did great business, and it stayed and it stayed and it stayed and it expanded. I really love that movie, and that made me really happy. and it seemed like if a movie like that is doing well at Camel View, I think it makes you think that independent film can do well. The new place, I'm sure, will be very nice, and you can describe it in many ways. But the one way you can't describe it is funky old art house. And that's what Camel View was, and that's what we're losing.
Bill Goody-Kuntz, film critic for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Bill, thanks.
Thank you.
In addition to being a favorite place to see a movie, the Camel View Theater building also has a following among people who appreciate its unique exterior. Walt Lockley is an architecture writer.
This is a movie theater. Started as a two- or three-plex. It's a five-plex now. And it simply sits on an outparcel of a mall. There's nothing, you know, particularly interesting about the inside. It's the outside. It's those three steel parasols out front that are worth attention and that put it in the category of, you know, these flamboyant mid-century, some people call them mid-century marvels. But there were a couple decades where people came to Phoenix and sort of spread out and did... experimentation and put up these exaggerated, very stylish bowling alleys and branch banks and space-age churches. And Camel View 5 clearly falls into that category. Those three steel parasols, I talked to the architect's son. He was on site in 73 and helping his father. He said that they actually are functional. They were meant to provide shade there where people stand in line to get in at the box office. And he said that they indicate a theatrical moment of arrival.
Where does Camel View rank to you as far as the types of sites we've lost recently in the Valley in terms of how interesting they are, even if not practical?
Camel View is an art house. In fact, it's one of, the two art houses in the state. So there were a lot of people who drove in from Ahwatukee or, you know, even Tucson, to see those special films that they wanted to see. I guess my opinion is contrary to many people, though, because there's a whole lot of architecture in the Valley. It's not exactly as if, you know, people talk as if we only have seven remarkable buildings left, you know,
yeah.
And they're being knocked down one by one. The Valley has a rich, deep, and important architectural history. Not everybody talks like that's true.
The man who's in charge of Camel View and is bringing it along to its new location is Dan Harkins, CEO and owner of Harkins Theaters. He was there when the Camel View was first built. Dan, has Camel View been, let's say, a complex part of your life as you've tried to balance art and commerce?
The Camel View has been where I feel like I learned the ropes. I was sort of weaned there. At a young age of 20, my dad put me in charge of the theater. I helped with construction, put in the seats, and came up with all the crazy ideas that later on became the Camel View we all know. My dad, unfortunately, passed away the year after Camel View opened. So Camel View opened in June of 73, and my dad left us the following April. And we could not get first-run films. The Hollywood studios were literally, and we proved this in federal court eventually about 30 years later, were conspiring with my competitors to keep first-run product away from my theater, first-run releases. So, and to stay alive, I brought in first-run because it was the only first-run films I could play. The Italian, French, English, Australian, imported movies, foreign films, subtitled, which was an obstacle there too. So you're right. There was this kind of like, how do I pay the bills and play films that are subtitled and on the big screen in French or Italian? It took a long time, and we fought really hard, stuck with it. And luckily, the local press and film critics helped a lot. And Camel View became one of the top five highest attended art imported independent cinema houses in the country.
What led to this? We're going to still have those films available. We just can't do it at this old theater anymore.
It was our landlord one day said, hey, you know, your lease is expired now, and you know, we want to rebuild something in the place of Camel View in the form of a high-rise building, an office or a condo complex, maybe a hotel, I'm not sure. Yeah. So really the death knell for the Camel View we know today was its death knell occurred when the city rezoned it for high-rise. And the developer said, well, why do we have this little five-plex movie theater there that pays old 1980s rent? You know, it's an economic decision. You know, they decided, well, and we said, please, we're begging, can we rebuild it somewhere else exactly as is, or ideally bigger and better so we can play more of the independent movies and art films? And that's what's happening. The new Camel View, which is just steps away from the old Camel View, is going to be amazing. And I got to tell you, I put away the handkerchief and stopped crying when I looked at the theater a couple weeks ago and got a preview. But hey, if you're hearing this broadcast and you think, well, what's going to happen to the art films that I loved at Camel View for 42 years? Well, bigger and better, because it's a 14-screen complex. So at least seven of those screens will be dedicated to exactly what the old Camel View played.
At least seven, really?
Okay. Yeah, and sometimes even more. If something's big, like The King's Speech, for example, or Black Swan, it'll be even on more screens.
There are a number of people who may be a little bit older,
yeah,
and who don't necessarily feel as comfortable standing in line next to someone who's buying a ticket for The Avengers or something like that. Is this going to be comfortable enough for people who were, again, were used to just sort of the easy walking up to Camel View?
Oh, sure.
There isn't sort of the clamor around it.
Yeah, there's always clamor when it's shows are selling out Saturday night at 7:30.
Right.
But stay away from Saturday night, and it's going to feel like the old Camel View because it naturally played that way. The Camel View and the Fashion Square Theater now melted together into this new 14-screen complex. It's just natural that the psychographics, iconographics, the demographics of that area just lean to a sophisticated, well-educated audience.
Dan Harkins, the man behind Harkins Theaters, which of course is based in the Valley. We're talking about the opening of the new Camel View next Thursday, December the 17th. Dan, thanks.
Hey, thank you. We'll see you at the movies.
The final showing at the original Camel View will be Spotlight at 7:30 tonight. The new Camel View will open with the latest Star Wars film, The Force Awakens.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news.
And Mark, checking the Valley freeways at this hour. Accidents on I-10 westbound at the 60. That's blocking the HOV lane. HOV lane also blocked by a collision I-10 westbound at Elliott. We'll stay partly to mostly sunny for the rest of this afternoon and may get up to a high temperature of 76. Then for tomorrow, cloudy with a slight chance for rain and highs in the upper 60s. Currently partly cloudy and 74 degrees at 2:54.
KJZZ is supported by Home Instead Senior Care, serving the Valley since 1997 as a source of non-medical in-home services for seniors, from scheduled personal care to continuous Alzheimer's care. Info at homeinstead.com.
We head now to another Valley Hot Corner, spots with a lot going on. But first, as always, let's meet our tour guide.
I'm Gwen Ashley Walters. I'm a food writer with Phoenix Magazine.
And where are we?
We are on the corner of Camelback Road and Central Avenue.
We're sitting outside at Uptown Plaza, kind of a blast from Phoenix's past. The center's currently undergoing a facelift and getting some new tenants.
I think it was really nice when they first built it, mid-century modern. And this was a Piggly Wiggly, and now it's an AJ's. AJ's is the anchor here, and they've been here for a long time, and I am sure they are thrilled that this is going to be redeveloped.
Well, I have to imagine that they'd like some more business, people coming in for other things here and maybe stop at AJ's as well, right?
Exactly, exactly. And there has been a lot of vacancies here recently. So really, I think people come into the shopping center for the AJ's and not a whole lot other, but that's going to change soon.
So what's coming in here?
Well, you know me, I'm focused on the restaurants.
Of course.
And actually, right next door to AJ's is a brand new Flower Child, which is the third location from Sam Fox that focuses, it's a fast casual and it
healthy
focuses on
food.
Healthy food. I think they say healthy food for a happy world or something like that. And it's a fun little place. And Shake Shack is going to come in
Not
here.
Not healthy.
Yes, you got to have balance, right, between the two. Shake Shack is an import from New York. I've eaten at the one in New York, and it is fantastic burgers. And basically what they're trying to do is be the anti-McDonald's and really do a fast casual burger spot, but really up on the ingredients and up on the price, too, a little bit, too. So, and they'll serve beer and wine.
What do you think it means for this neighborhood to have this shopping center sort of revitalized? And I think the plan is to bring it back to what it looked like in the mid-50s when it was built.
It is. They are actually ripping off the stucco that's on here now to expose the original brick. So it will have that retro, old-timey brick feeling to it, but they're also going to put some real modern steel and other touches so that it'll look modern, but it'll also feel a little bit retro too.
And you can kind of see some of the brick on the back building there. They've already exposed that.
Stripping that off, yeah.
Is this a desirable thing for restaurateurs? Like, do they want to be in a center like this that maybe doesn't have the world's greatest reputation but has been getting a lot of attention for what's going to be coming?
I think they really want to be here because of that. But obviously, the newness and the redevelopment, that's going to generate a lot of buzz and excitement, but also because there is this strong anchor of AJ's here. So there's kind of built-in traffic, and that's always good for restaurants.
This is a major intersection, but it's a very busy intersection. Is that a concern, do you think, that it's tough to make left turns here? There's a lot of traffic during rush hour here. Is that something that restaurant folks think about or worry about?
Well, I'm sure they think about it, but one of the great things about this, really, there's ample parking here, and some of the newer developments that are being infill redevelopments don't have as much luxury in the parking department. And I think that's really going to help people here. But sure, maybe a left turn here or there, but in rush hour will be kind of hectic. But other than that, I mean, this is a serious corner. Who doesn't want to be on this corner?
Are you thinking that there's going to be a lot of lunch business here from offices nearby? I mean, do you think restaurants here can get a steady dinner business based on who's nearby?
Oh, I think they can definitely get a steady dinner business here, because if you think about, right behind here is the Windsor Historic District. I think there's a lot of neighborhoods around here that will do that. And, you know, I have to give a shout out to Aaron Chamberlain. In 2009, he opened St. Francis, and he did an infill redevelopment. He totally redid an old building. And that, I think that kind of helped people see that this was an area ripe for some new restaurants.
And this is clearly sort of the mid-century modern part of Phoenix. I mean, you go up and down Central a little bit, you can really sort of see Phoenix's past in the 50s and 60s.
Yes.
It seems like the plan is that this will sort of tie into that and maybe help some of the restaurants and other businesses that are maybe a little bit, you know, slightly further west of here.
Exactly. Well, only three blocks away is the Newton, and that's where the Southern Rail is. And then only three blocks north of here is all of the Upward Projects. Windsor,
Federal Pizza,
Joyride Tacos, and Postinos. So I think there's, you know, all of that synergy kind of builds together, and I know everybody around here is happy.
With any new construction, timelines are often kind of fungible, let's say.
Liquid,
right. So how does that sort of play into a restaurant's thinking as far as opening and having their facilities and getting their build out done and sort of making sure that their business is ready to go when the rest of the development is ready to go?
There's two schools of thought on that. Some restaurateurs like to wait to open closer to the summer season, just because they know it's going to be a little bit slower, and that'll give them some time to get their sea legs underneath of them. Right, a soft opening, and just really kind of work on tightening up the ship before a season hits. But then there's others who really like, no, I mean, we are ready to go, and I would think a Shake Shack will be ready to go on day one once they open, because they've done this before. They know, you know, they've got all their systems in place.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food writer for Phoenix Magazine. We met at Uptown Plaza on the corner of Central and Camelback in Phoenix. Remember to join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show, how a Valley American Indian community is diversifying its economic development portfolio, and Sun Devil Stadium's transformation from just a football stadium to a full-on event venue. Those stories and much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. Our news director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John, the Ascendant One, Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas, stuff going on in your neighborhood that we should be talking about. The show at KJZZ.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.